Marty Moss Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Back in 1972, Taylor Brandt shared an apartment with Bill and Hillary Clinton when they were all working on George McGovern's failed presidential campaign. They later went their separate ways, the Clintons to Arkansas and later the White House. Taylor Brandt became a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, historian, author of a trilogy of biographies on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Shortly after becoming president, Clinton asked Brandt if he would document his private thoughts and observations about his presidency to be used for his memoir and for future historians. Brandt eventually agreed, and about once a month he was smuggled into the White House to record their late-night conversations about major events, about scandals, political personalities, the press, impeachment, anything that was on President Clinton's mind. While Clinton hid those tapes in his sock drawer, Brandt recorded his own impressions of the Clinton presidency after their sessions. They became the basis for his new book. It's called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. And Taylor Brandt, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Nice to have you here. So how different was the Bill Clinton of 72 and the one that you met 20 years later in the White House?
Well, one was a kid. We were in our 20s, and it was a very bonding experience. We got shellacked in Texas, and we felt the winds of history in our ears because it was the height of the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandals, and politics were very much in the air, but we were young. And 20 years later, I felt like Rip Van Winkle. I hadn't gone to sleep for 20 years, hadn't seen this guy, and the next time I see him, he's president-elect of the United States.
But in 72, did you say to yourself, gosh, this guy's got presidential possibilities?
Absolutely not. I thought he was good. He was good at what he did, but we were peers. He wasn't that much better than I was. you know, we were running the state together. But then to come back and find all of those political gifts that at times were pretty awe-inspiring, that his memory for statistics, his relish for politics, even adverse politics, was really astonishing at times, and his relentless cerebral intellect trying to figure out what was going on as a puzzle solver and somebody who was just absolutely enraptured with the political world.
Did you vote for him in 92, or did you support his candidacy?
Well, I did, but I have to say I told him the first time I saw him that I had, in Maryland, in the Maryland primaries, you could cast split votes, and that I voted some for him and some for Paul Tsongas, which really wounded him because I thought Paul Tsongas was serious about the deficit. And I think I did one of my votes for Jesse Jackson. And because his slogan, the forgotten middle class, to me sounded a little bit too much like Nixon's silent majority, which we had campaigned against. And I thought maybe he had been processed into a homogenized politician. He disabused me of that pretty quickly.
Now, his idea was really a more formal job for you to be the White House historian, or I guess the Clinton historian. And you had this other idea, a much more sort of informal conversation, series of conversations with the president.
He wanted me to be his Arthur Schlesinger and move into the White House for however long it took. It would have been 7 years or whatever, and write the authorized history. And I said that my job was to give him my best advice on what would serve the public for revitalizing the history and how we really understand what our presidents do, and that I thought an authorized biography wouldn't work because in this day and age it would be seen as too biased, and that I wouldn't myself, if I was going to live there for 7 years, feel comfortable with trying to render an impartial judgment. I would be too partial. And in fact, in this book, this is a primary record and a memoir. I make no pretense here of assessing Bill Clinton and coming to a judgment about him. It was too amazing an experience. I'm trying to record what it's like to be with the President of the United States and give people a first look at how he thinks and the substance of the material. That's enough. You know, and I told him, you know, make your history and try to keep a good record. You can't really control it, even if you try. So give that up. And we lit on this diary idea as a kind of a second best alternative.
But it was an interesting, and at times it seems I don't know if difficult is too strong a word, but you were a friend. You became his diarist. You helped to write his inauguration. You were a go-between between Clinton and Aristide. I mean, you played more of a role than just being a diarist for President Clinton.
Right. I was wrestling history, too.
Yes.
He was wrestling it in the sense of saying overtly that a lot of our politics today is wrestling about what our history means. Is government a positive force in our life? Can it be? Should it be? What's the Constitution say? That's really wrestling history. I was always at sea to some degree about my role because the primary role was trying to compile this record and do and say whatever it took to get him to speak most candidly and leave the most voluminous record for the future, even after we're dead, you know, for people to study. But what do you do if you're trying to do that? And he says, well, what do you think of this? Or should I fire the CIA director? Well, I'm also a citizen, and he's also being president, not just remembering president. So you got a lot of different roles going on, and I, you know, part of me felt quite candidly that if we didn't have a rapport that depended on honest advice and reactions, that he would lose interest in the process or perhaps lose interest in working with me. So it was a very complex enterprise.
Now, how are you able to keep this secret? Because it seems to me you can't just walk in and out of the White House. You have to go through all sorts of security. But I know that you went late at night when I assume there were fewer people there. But nonetheless, the idea of kind of coming and going to the White House without some member of the press seeing you.
Well, the
press seems unusual.
Yes. Well, it was at night, and our sessions were in the residence, almost all of them. I think we had a couple in the Oval Office, which very quickly established themselves as disasters because people would walk in on us. And over in the West Wing, where the Oval Office is, there's staff everywhere. And every single one of them is wondering what I'm
Who's
doing
this guy,
there.
Right?
You know, what's he doing? And particularly, what's he doing with the president alone and not, you know, in the context of a big meeting? So almost very quickly, we did them instead at night in the residence where there was no staff around, and I would come and park my pickup truck that I was driving down from Baltimore under the Truman balcony, get cleared through. And I had to have the right people to clear me through. But the White House is a very strange thing. There are all these zones of security that you have to go through. But once you get to the inner sanctum, you don't even need an ID. I could have not even had a wallet. If you're around the president, I never saw him with a wallet. So once you get actually with him, you're kind of in this inner zone.
And why was it so important to keep it secret?
Well, he was convinced, rightly, I believe, that if it got out, that there would be a huge hue and cry going up that the secrets to Whitewater or the Vince Foster scandal or anything else were in these tapes, and that nobody could rest until they got hold of them to find out what was in there, and that would kill the project. So it is a paradoxical thing. We're trying to be secret in order to be now for candor later. We're trying because we really believe that if you didn't keep these things secret, you wouldn't be able to build up his trust that he was controlling this and that he could say things frankly that weren't on the public record that he would otherwise forget and leave them there. This is what I think was really going on, he would say.
And when you say and others say that these tapes were kept in his sock drawer, is that a real sock drawer or a kind of metaphoric sock drawer?
No, it's where his socks were.
It's where his socks were.
But
okay.
I didn't know this. He didn't show me where he was keeping them during the first term. And I don't know. I've never asked him whether it was only because that after we had kept it secret for so long and he had gotten reelected and that he trusted me. Several times when the sessions were over, he'd say, here, you put it away, because he would get called away to do something else. And just the mechanics and the logistics made it hard for him to do it. And I was always worried that he was going to leave them somewhere and that somebody would throw the tapes out. They're these tiny little micro cassette tapes. So during the second term, he said, here, let me show you where they are. And we went into his bathroom there off the living room, right next to his bedroom with Hillary. And it's a big walk-in closet. And the top drawer, you open it up, there are a lot of socks. And in the back, he had the two boxes that I had given him to keep the two sets of tapes. We had a backup in case one of the machines malfunctioned. And he said, here, when you put them away, you can make sure that we've got a full set of both of them. And so from then on, that's what I would do.
So does he fold his socks or put them in a, you know, a little bunch? Or was it a messy sock drawer? Do you remember?
No, it was a very, very neat sock drawer, but not because of him, because of his valets.
Was it hard for you to keep a secret? I mean, here, this was going on for 8 years, and this was a very controversial, contentious time in U.S. history. You were sitting next to the President of the United States, had 79 interviews with him. Was it hard for you to be mum about what you knew or your opinions about the president?
Absolutely, it was. It was hard not to say there's a lot more to this president than people think, or I think somewhere in there I say I felt like I was on a different planet from the political culture that was all dwelling on these trivia and these tabloid things, and what I saw of him was a relentless president trying to figure out how about the world. He loved politics and thought it really mattered. And I agreed with him. But because I agreed with him, I was all the more determined to preserve this history and not jeopardize it. Because if I talked, then this thing would collapse. And I really believe that we need to have a better sense of how our leaders really govern and what they're like as people, and to have the personal reinforce the political rather than substitute for it. And that we're disjointed in our history about politics and what it can and can't do.
In fact, you say he is/was more candid and idealistic than your, as you say, your fellow scribes. I'm assuming members of the press, people that were writing about Clinton.
Yes, but that judgment would have just been dismissed as ridiculous, and it may still be. And it became some of the byplay between us, because when I left Texas in 1972, I was disillusioned with politics like most people and said, I'm going to go into journalism because there's more integrity that way. And my friend Bill Clinton is too much, his ambition and political is driving him into politics to ignore how crass it is and how superficial it is. And we had a couple of conversations about it at the end. I said, you know, I'm really... It upsets me now to find the political world and the writing world and the thinking world so cynical about you, when my exposure to you and my direct experience is that you're more idealistic and retain more of our youthful idealism than my own colleagues. But nobody in the outside world would believe me. And he said that if you really want to fix things in the world, you have to develop an aptitude and a patience for handling the petty problems of politics and work through human nature and not go off and try to work around it, which is what a lot of journalists do, to pretend that it's not there and that sort of thing. And when we were kids, I thought that was just his ambition talking. Later on, I thought maybe he was wiser than I gave him credit for.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Taylor Branch is our guest, and we're talking about his new book. It's a big thing. I'm holding it in my hands here. It's called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. And during the Clinton administration, President Clinton invited him to spend something like 80 sessions talking about the Clinton White House, views of politics and the presidency. And Taylor Branch, our guest today on Radio Times. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about. Stay with us after this short break. We'll be right back.
The Drexel University School of Public Health supports WHYY and hosts an open house Wednesday, October 7th at 5:30 p.m. Drexel has the only school of public health in Greater Philadelphia and offers fully accredited doctoral and master's programs that stress real-world experience and offer full-time, weekend, and online options. For information, 1-800-2-DREXEL or publichealth.drexel.edu. The Drexel University School of Public Health.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 10:20. Ahead in the second hour at 11, a look at the origins of modern domestic life in 17th century Paris. Today's forecast, delightful. Sunny skies, breezy. This afternoon's high, 68 degrees. Clear overnight, low falling back to 49. Tomorrow, sunny to start. Clouding up later in the day, high 69 degrees. And then the chance of showers overnight, perhaps into Wednesday morning. Then some clearing, Wednesday's high, 68 degrees.
Addiction is a major public health problem in this country. But beyond numbers, the heartbreaking stories are about the people and families affected by addiction. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk with Benoit Denizé Lewis, author of America Anonymous. A recovering addict, he followed 8 people struggling with everything from gambling to overeating to substance abuse. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. If you're just joining us, Taylor Branch is our guest. And back in the 90s, when Bill Clinton was president, Taylor Branch made a number of secret recordings with the president about the presidency. Bill Clinton kept those tapes in his sock drawer. He used them to write his memoir, and hopefully, eventually, they'll be used by future historians. Our guest, Taylor Branch, made his own recordings after those interviews on his long drive home to Baltimore. And those recordings became the subject of his new book called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. I don't think any president likes the press, and I don't think Clinton was any different. But you write, in a recurring thing, President Clinton was uniquely passive about the press. He treated bad publicity as a scourge to be endured rather than a problem to be dissected, managed, even positively transformed. Why do you think he was made so passive by press criticism?
I don't know. We discussed that a lot. He used to say that he was disillusioned by press criticism much more than political opposition, which he never fussed about. And he had surprisingly fraternal relations with Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole and his political enemies off the record. They were kind of like opposing lawyers at lunch. They would laugh and joke, but not with the press. And he said it was because he was disillusioned by the press, that he had looked up to the New York Times and the Washington Post in particular for a long time, and yet they were the very ones who were carrying the Whitewater scandals and the travel gate and the this gate and the that gate and the and even the Vince Foster case in league with the special prosecutor, which developed it and carried the story legally. But he didn't take it as something to turn his charm on those reporters. He just kind of recoiled. In the beginning, he yelled and screamed about it. There are a lot of tirades about the press, but then he'd start thinking about it. Why are they doing this? And actually, at some times, he even anticipated the current disintegration of the market, saying they're following the tabloid stuff because their markets are disintegrating in the cable era, and maybe they don't have any choice. But and then finally, he just said, I can't even worry about it anymore. I've just got to get up in the morning and do my job and not worry about the fact that they're obsessed with stuff that I don't think it matters to the American people.
But it sounds like he took it personally.
Absolutely.
Their criticism.
He did take it personally. And he said several times, I'm bitter about it. I can't hide it. And in fact, he said he felt sorry for himself over it, which he said was his central character flaw.
Do you think he's still bitter about it today?
And
I'm thinking about last year's presidential campaign when he was very much on the trail for his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
I would say probably so. I don't know about bitter, but I think he's still very sensitive and still thinks that we have a dysfunctional press that cares about the things that don't matter and that's a disservice to the American people. I mean, he has said to me several times, that isn't it amazing that there's, to his knowledge, never been a retrospective on what it might mean to future generations that we were on a track to pay off the national debt by now? And instead, we've doubled it, and that means that every child born has a public mortgage hanging over them of several $100,000 that they have to pay the interest on every year, even when they're a baby, before we pay for the first soldier or the first public salary. He said these things matter, and instead, we're all obsessed with spitballs and a pretense that either the left or the right has all the answers in America.
He seemed to think one of his biggest mistakes was, I guess, giving the green light to a special prosecutor, which, of course, opened up the door to Whitewater and Vince Foster and the White House travel office and on and on and on and on.
On and on, that it gave it a legal linchpin. And actually, he said that was the biggest mistake of his presidency, but he also said that the one who most staunchly believed that was Hillary, and that Hillary told him that it was not only a political mistake, but it was a constitutional mistake, because the special counsel should be reserved for abuses of power that could logically lead to impeachment. That's the basis of the constitutional balance. And that once he had empowered a special prosecutor on things that were not presidential, where even before his presidency, he destabilized things to the point that he couldn't even supervise the executive branch, which is what the Constitution charges him to do. And she said that he was doing a disservice to future presidents. And in our encounters in these sessions, she felt that way to the very end.
Do you think, this is, whether you like Bill Clinton or not, there's no getting around his political smarts.
Yeah.
But do you think he misread Congress at the time, or he felt that he could somehow steer these investigations, knowing that for the most part they came up with absolutely nothing?
Well, part of it was that he knew that there was absolutely nothing, and he believed that in a fair world that would be shown, and he thought it would be shown in short order. And Hillary is saying, no, once they get their teeth in you, they'll drag this thing out forever.
Was he naive?
Yes, and it feeds into his disillusionment with the press, because the great hue and cry in the press was, what's he hiding? Let's get to the bottom of this. A special prosecutor can answer all of these questions, and we can get on with it. And he said he was naive in the sense that he thought they'd actually do that and didn't realize the degree to which it was always a mirage, that there never was a question. Nobody to this day can put into one sentence what Whitewater was, and there was nothing to it, but it sustained investigations for 8 years. In fact, Ken Starr's office continued to 2004. It started in 1993. That's 11 years. That's a long time.
You can put into one sentence, though, what happened with Monica Lewinsky. And I know that you talked with him. It sounded like reluctantly bringing it up with him. First of all, why were you reluctant to do that?
Well,
it was all over the news.
It was all over the news, but it was searingly personal. I didn't know a lot of the details. It was a risk to record about it, because if it got out and he ever said that, it would heighten the risk to our tapes. And I squirmed about it. I didn't really want to ask him about it myself. Later on in the process, after he did talk about it, I apologized to him, saying, as your friend, I should have asked you or offered to talk about Lewinsky more, but I didn't. I was worried that it would interfere with the history project. I was worried that it would complicate my relations with Hillary, because Hillary came in and knew about these projects, and she knew I was talking to him about Lewinsky, which, because she knew an awful lot of, there were times when I wrote President Clinton very personal letters of advice, just a few times when I was really concerned about his state of mind or health, the stress there, and the answers. And I'd get a note back from Hillary. So I had sent him a very personal thing. I think they shared everything. And it was like intruding on their marriage to a certain degree. And for a history project that I didn't think really belonged on historical matters, at least until impeachment, I steered clear of it.
And he said, as you write here, he says to you, and he says it over and over again, I think I just cracked. And this is developing this relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Cracked how?
His resolve that he had more important things to do, and that whatever his straying ways had been before, that these historical stakes in the White House were too great, cracked under the weight of his disillusionment that nothing he could do could make all the scandals go away. And then he felt sorry for himself. And if you notice, his explanation only makes sense. The Monica Lewinsky affair was a very strange, truncated thing. He had a few sessions with her after the Republicans took the Congress and shut down the government, when he's feeling sorry for himself that he thought he had put the country on a path to economic success, and then was branded a socialist tax raiser and lost the Congress. And then the second time was after he won re-election in 1996, thought he was going to get a new lease on life for his agenda, and instead they came in with the Paula Jones scandal and the China Gate, saying that he had sold nuclear secrets to the Chinese and that sort of thing. And he just said the scandal is never going to go. And both times is when he took up with Monica Lewinsky, feeling sorry for himself and his resolve to reform, and that the stakes were bigger, cracked.
You write, the silence was unbearable. This is after he tells you that I think I just cracked. Well, I said the great sadness for me was that he had come so close to proving all the scandals baseless. Now Lewinsky alone vindicated cynicism. That he gave them, in a way, gave them ammunition to use against him.
That there would never be a reckoning for all of the years of that cynicism and the dodge of real politics in all of this tabloid stuff. He let them off the hook. And he would say, you know, our mission here is to bring America out of cynicism. We all agree that we're in a cynical era. And to him, that meant restoring the notion that there were good things that you could accomplish in politics if you took it seriously, and that being a politician shouldn't automatically be a cuss word because George Washington and Abraham Lincoln are politicians, and we all live better lives because of it. And, of course, for him and me as Southerners, white Southerners who had grown up under segregation, we knew that politics, in part, and a citizens' movement changed the everyday life of our region of the country for the betterment of everybody, black and white. It overcame segregation. You and I were even talking before on the air.
That's right.
The South was not fit for sports teams when it was segregated. You never heard of the Sun Belt when it was segregated. It made it prosperous. It destigmatized Southern politicians so that they could. We knew that politics, by all right, should have a wonderful reputation, but instead, for some reason, since that very same 1960s, the dominant idea in politics is that government is bad and that politics is inherently corrupt. And he was trying, and he thought that would harm the country, and that his mission was to try to rescue us from cynicism, and instead, with Monica Lewinsky, he threw away that effort. That's his great regret.
And great failing, you think, too?
Yes.
Taylor Branch, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of a trilogy of biographies on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He's got a new book, and that's what we've been talking about, called The Clinton Tapes, and it's subtitled Wrestling History with the President. And we're covering a fair amount of presidential history back in the 90s when Bill Clinton was the President of the United States, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, since you had written these biographies on Dr. King, and you include in your book a mention of Dr. King and his philandering ways, and you write, in King's case, I found signs of devouring guilt that drove him to seek penance in deeds of historic sacrifice. I had no strong theories about what drove Clinton. The stories of his philandering were troublesome, and so was the arrogant judgment from afar. But interesting, I mean, two influential, powerful men who, you know, had affairs, and sounds like for Clinton it was a different kind of struggle for him than it was for King.
Yeah, it was, although I didn't know as much about Clinton. I mean, when we were in Texas, he and Hillary were a new item, and we were in our 20s, and they were very much in love and very romantic. So I didn't notice any philandering then. I just heard the rumors over the intervening 20 years and figured, you know, he, like a lot of people. I mean, it's not like this is a rare problem. I mean, this is true for St. Augustine all the way down to Paul Tillich, one of the great theologians. There's a lot of womanizing in the world.
Especially with people in power.
Especially with people in power.
That great aphrodisiac.
Is what people say, and there's a lot of fascination with it, and a moral charge on it. But how it relates to what you do in public office and to your public life, I never say that it's unrelated because it's too personal, it's too close to your character. But I do think that it's a mistake to say that there's some automatic causal relation that anybody like St. Augustine or Jack Kennedy that has affairs cannot stand for anything worthwhile in public life. I mean, that to me is a ridiculous charge, and we ought to be consistent about it if we're gonna uphold that standard, which I don't think is valid.
Well, I thought what was interesting after all the impeachment and investigations is that the members of Congress began to admit that they too had been having affairs.
Yes, one Speaker of the House, they could hardly get him installed before it came out that he'd been having affairs all over the place. And of course, we keep having that now. I mean, the standard joke in journalism is to just say all you have to do is look at England, where the Tory politicians are always wearing stockings and doing some strange thing, to realize that, you know, this kind of human foible does not respect political labels.
You spent so much time in the private residence of the White House, and you got to see how the Clintons lived as a family. And I guess it is possible to be a family above the Oval Office. And there's scenes where Chelsea's coming in with homework questions that she wants to talk to her dad about. But you got to see both Hillary and Bill Clinton together as a couple. You saw them also when they were young and in love. And They've often been described as a power couple, that it's the power that's the glue, the aphrodisiac that keeps them together. How do you understand that relationship?
Well, I think that it's still mysterious from the portrait that you have here. I believe that it was important and with some trepidation for fear that it would be an intrusion on the Clintons to include Hillary and Chelsea, but they were included in our sessions. They would come in there. They would talk. Hillary would sometimes come in and hold his hand and stand there while he's answering questions. There was tremendous warmth between them. I'm not talking about romantic or erotic warmth, but there was a partnership that was far beyond this kind of cold-blooded power play that people attributed to them. They talked about any and everything. They finished one another's sentences. Their minds roamed over political problems all over the place, and I describe some of that. But at the same time, they talked a lot about the family, about Chelsea, about humor. The reason I put them in there is because I want people to see. I had a very strange window to see the president being a family man and president and a historian and a thinker about politics all at once, and I think that's what the reality is. And so I deliberately wanted to include those personal moments in there so you could get a sense of the balance of this person that we have. After all, this is the only branch of our government that's invested in one person. And in our Constitution, we've got one person who's doing all this, which is one reason I was so outraged that we focused all of this silly scandal that had nothing to do with the powers of the presidency as a way to evade what politics were in that period. So I wanted to try to balance the personal and the presidential in this record.
He tells you that one of the things that he admires about his daughter, Chelsea, is her determination and her focus. And you spend a lot of time with President Clinton, and he's playing cards and he's doing crossword puzzles and he's fielding phone calls and he's multitasking while he's carrying on these interviews with you as well. And it seems that he admired something in his daughter that really isn't part of himself.
Yes, the two parts to that. The concentration when he can be scattered, although he tended to be scattered where he was doing well on everything that he was doing when he was multitasking, that his mind was too active just to do one thing. But the other thing was, he said, Chelsea pursued ballet for which she was not naturally gifted, meaning not naturally in the top. She was too bigger than all the rest of them. He said her feet bled every day for 10 years after rehearsal, that she suffered a lot for it because she wasn't natural. And he said, I've admired that in her because I've only pursued in my life the things for which I was gifted. I knew I was gifted in politics. And she pursued ballet because she loved it, whether she was gifted for it or not. When he said that, it was pretty clear that part of him really admires Chelsea and her sense of balance. And there are other little stories about that in the book. But he was worried that this same story would be seized upon for people distorting, saying that he was accusing his own daughter of not having the ideal body for a ballerina or whatever. How you come at these personal stories depends on what your angle and what the context is.
Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Taylor Branch. He's got a new book called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, and he had many sessions with President Clinton, secret sessions in the White House back in the 90s. 1-888-477-9499.
ChristianaCare supports WHYY and your efforts to stay healthy. The ChristianaCare Arrhythmia Center helps people who experience irregular heartbeat, also known as arrhythmia. For those with a racing heart or one that beats too fast, who have had problems with their heartbeat or have fainted, an arrhythmia assessment may be needed. ChristianaCare encourages people with these symptoms to talk to a doctor. Details at 800-693-CARE or ChristianaCare.org/arrhythmia.
It's 10:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. In the second hour at 11, a look at the origins of modern domestic life in 17th century Paris. Today's forecast, sunny skies, this afternoon's high 68 degrees, breezy as well. Clear overnight, low falling back to 49. Tomorrow, sunshine starts the day off, then a few clouds roll in the afternoon, high 69 degrees. And then the chance of showers overnight into Wednesday morning, any rain clearing out midday.
I've got your picture that you gave to me.
Roseanne Cash was 18 when her father, Johnny Cash, wrote a list of songs he thought she should know. On the next Fresh Air, we hear some of those and talk with Roseanne Cash. Her new album is called The List. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. For the 8 years he was in the White House, President Clinton hid tapes of late-night private conversations he had with Taylor Branch in his sock drawer. And Taylor Branch had conducted 79 interviews with Clinton, and those sessions covered the gamut. And our guest, Taylor Branch, kept his own record of their conversations, and that's the basis for his new book called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. And we have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get a couple of callers in on the conversation. We've got Richard from University City. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My question, it's more my observations, and I'm wondering if your guest, Mr. Branch, agrees with this assessment of President Clinton. I very much liked him from the beginning. I'm liking him again now. But it seems that during the course of his presidency, his style was to build consensus, to be led by the middle, to dive for the middle, which to me is different from leading.
Well, let me see what Taylor Branch has to say about that, Richard, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. As you said, Taylor Branch, when he was running for president, he talked about the middle. That was one of the reasons you weren't necessarily as enamored of Clinton as others.
If you're not thinking about the middle, you can't get elected. But if you're thinking only about what's in the middle, and you're really a finger in the wind politician, which is what he was constantly accused of, then you can't really lead anywhere. So as the caller says, it's a bind. I think the only thing I would point out that surprised me in the course of doing these sessions was how often I found him in the throes of doing something with virtually zero public support, and he did it anyway. He's the first president to take on the tobacco industry, the first president who took on the gun lobby any number of times, passed the Brady Bill, the assault weapons ban, all these other things. President Obama today, for all of his credit, as a visionary leader, openly says, I'm not going to take on the gun lobby because it's political suicide. He invaded Haiti to restore the President Aristide, which was something that I cared about a lot. He said he had 8% public support for it, and he did it anyway, even though his own allies in Congress were saying, if there's one casualty, you'll be impeached, because nobody wants to do this. He bailed out Mexico and Indonesia when the Congress didn't want him to do it. So there were any number of times when he's doing things, and Bosnia and Kosovo, he had zero support for those things. He labored with those for a long time. So there are lots of times where he did care about getting things done in the center, because that's where politics is vibrant. But that doesn't mean that he has no convictions, because he risked severe sanction, if not political disaster, on any number of occasions by taking on unpopular causes.
Richard, thanks for the call. Let me get Paul from Haddonfield to join our conversation. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Cool. I'd like to ask Taylor Branch about suggestions that Clinton had insight that Osama bin Laden was targeting the United States and was able to take some shots at him during his presidency, but was distracted by the Lewinsky scandal. Could you comment on anything you know about how much of a threat Osama bin Laden was perceived to be by Clinton, and to what extent he was distracted from that?
Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Taylor Branch, go ahead.
There are several episodes in which he talks on this tape record about Osama bin Laden, and I had never heard of Osama bin Laden when he's talking about it, so I didn't know anything about it. And he calls him, he told me that Osama bin Laden was something like James Bond, the villains in James Bond.
That's right. In fact, I'll quote you here, okay. Taylor Branch. President Clinton stated flatly that Osama bin Laden, the architect of this coordinated terrorist attack, this is referring to Kenya and Tanzania, was eerily like the fictional villains in James Bond movies. That was his analysis.
That was his analysis. And then then later on, when he went to South Asia because he feared nuclear war in South Asia, I mean, he told me, I hope I'm here next time because we have reports that bin Laden's people are going to try to kill me in Bangladesh and in Pakistan, to the degree that he flew in and landed in Pakistan in a fake plane and had other officers landed in an empty Air Force One. He said, that's their job, to take the hit for me. They were afraid of a shoulder-fired missile. They tried to capture bin Laden people in a specific house with shoulder-fired missiles. So, and, of course, he had several airstrikes in both Afghanistan and the Sudan trying to take out Osama bin Laden, to kill him. So, yes, there was a lot. I don't know that it's fair to say that he was distracted by Monica Lewinsky. Monica Lewinsky was a burden, but he pursued not only Osama bin Laden, but lots of other things at the same time.
Let me get Michelle from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was just wondering if President Clinton had ever mentioned on the tapes or talked to him about what was going on in Rwanda and his inaction there, if he had ever expressed any personal feelings or regrets. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Michelle, for the call. Taylor Branch?
There are several mentions of Rwanda in the tapes. Of course, these tapes are real time, so they're happening as it was occurring. He said right after Rwanda that the initial massacres occurred so rapidly in Central Africa that doing anything by the time they could, even if they had been mobilized, it would have been very difficult to do very much, and certainly not in the kind of international coalition that it took him so long to mobilize for Bosnia and Kosovo. Having rationalized that, in other words, so I think right at the time he didn't feel badly about it, but later on, when he went there and he visited those people, and there's one particularly poignant scene in Kosovo where he sits down with Kosovars and Albanians who are still angry with one another after the war and says, to them, I sat in Rwanda with families that had been hacked to death and lost limbs with machetes, and they killed 700,000 people without even any guns in 3 weeks' time. You have to make – this is not a problem that just you have. This is all over the world. And he tries to make this pitch for peacemaking. And he called it later on that Africa trip, he called it a great regret that we didn't respond rapidly. But at the time – so there are two signals there. At the time, he's saying that as badly as he felt about not doing it, it was really impractical to have expected an international coalition to have mobilized in Central Africa as quickly as this genocide occurred.
How do you think history will judge President Clinton as a historian yourself? And I realize it takes time to put things into context, but nonetheless.
Well, I think that it'll be better, certainly, than it was, that the public image and the public culture has filtered through the media is pretty much totally scandal president, to the point that there are very little retrospectives that talk about the things that he accomplished or was trying to do. His opportunity in history, I think, will be that that he tried to point the way toward a lot of a lot of essential reforms that we needed to do in climate, economy, jobs, and education to revitalize ourselves for the future. But he didn't succeed in nearly as many of them as he needed to be a great transformational president.
What do you think his fatal flaw was as a political leader, as a president?
Well, he said self-pity.
Do you agree with that?
Well, I think to the degree that anybody has self-pity, it is immobilizing and it distorts your judgment. So, yes, I do agree with that. But I think also that he underestimated the forces of cynicism. I mean, I'll just put it right out there. I believe that a lot of the problem with President Clinton was not with President Clinton. It was with us. That we didn't realize how big a stake we had in actually dealing with the political matters that he was raising, and we're still dealing with them on climate change and all of that sort of sense with a truncated sense that politics really is not up to these challenges, and if it's not, then it will be to our peril.
It sounds like, and you spent 8 years about once a month with President Clinton, that he really won you over, that perhaps you came into this project a little more cynical about him as a politician, as a political leader, maybe even as a man, but left feeling differently about him.
I think that's fair. I don't offer a judgment in this. To me, to collect the record was all I could do. I'm not necessarily saying that everything he wanted to do I agree with, but he certainly won me over in the sense that his motivations, which people were so free to ascribe ugly or nasty motivations or cynical motivations, I think that reflects their cynicism more than his, and that whether he was right or wrong, he was dealing with and trying to deal with things that mattered and belonged in the political system on the merits, and that on the merits he was trying to put out things that we would have been a lot better to deal with than to get distracted into all those scandals.
Why do you think, though, Dick Morris was hired, and he was at a certain juncture in the Clinton White House to do some political work, and I have to say when I see him on, I think it's probably on Fox, he is one of the more personal and virulent critics of both of the Clintons, not just Bill Clinton, but Hillary Clinton as well. And I've never understood what that relationship was about. Do you understand it?
Well, I have. There's a very funny scene in the book where I took a big hit. The only time I ever wrote about Clinton during his presidency was during the 1996 election. I didn't mention Dick Morris because Clinton hadn't been mentioning him in these sessions. But I was constrained because I couldn't mention that we'd been having these sessions, and I didn't want to endanger the session. So when I went out and did interviews on this article, people said, well, you neglected Dick Morris. And I couldn't say he never talks about Dick Morris. And then went to the convention and only to find that Dick Morris was right across the room, hall from me at the convention. And he was there, but he was there among many other consultants. You know, and then, of course, the very next morning, before I could introduce myself, the scandal broke of him with the prostitutes, and he's out the door. So I never did, it turns out, get to meet him. But I think that Dick Morris represents a projection on the part of people who wanted to believe that this totally cynical campaign consultant had Clinton as putty in his hands. And he has perpetuated that ever since.
He sure has.
I know for a fact that he hasn't had personal conversations with them for a heck of a long time, but he still postures as though he knows their innermost motivations. And the freedom to ascribe motivations, particularly corrupt motivations, to a political leader is, in my view, one of the slippery slopes of modern journalism in the era when modern journalism is losing its grip on the American people. And so the fact that he's been rehabilitated into a permanent oracle on their character faults says more about us than it does about his accuracy as a reader of Clinton.
How would you describe the relationship between Vice President Al Gore and President Bill Clinton? And near the end of the book, you describe a pretty contentious argument that they have. This is about the 2000 election when Clinton basically says to Gore, look, I could have helped you win this 2000 election. And Gore said, you cost me this election. You were essentially an albatross around my neck. How would you describe the relationship between these two men?
Well, it goes all the way through the book, and there's sometimes when it's funny, there's sometimes when it's collaborative, it's sometimes when he actually looks up to Gore. Even at the end, in this meeting, which I didn't even know about, I didn't know to ask him. This is one of those things where he says, well, you're not going to ask me this because it's not on the record, but I want to get it down that Al came in here and we had a real Donnybrook for 2 hours after the Bush-Gore election was decided. To Clinton's credit, and I think this is consistent with him, he gives Gore's side of the argument pretty well. He says what Gore attacked him for and that he didn't expect it, right down to the fact that Gore attacked him for not being more personal about Monica Lewinsky. You didn't apologize to me. And Clinton said, what does that have to do with, you know, this was a searing embarrassment. I was saying the same thing in public. This proves to me that you're a creature of Washington, that you believe I can never apologize enough, and that I owe this serial apology. He said, Al, Hillary has a hell of a lot more reason to resent me for Monica Lewinsky than you do, but she still ran on unabashedly on our record in New York and won because she was political enough to see that. You ran away from our record and lost. And that's what we should be talking about here, not who owes who what apology. That's the fixation of the Washington political culture.
So where are these tapes that were hidden in Clinton's sock drawer in the White House? Where are they today?
The last time I saw them was at Chappaqua when he was writing his memoirs, and I was up there. That's another chapter at right. the end of the book, and we had a big set too about that. But they were there, and the transcripts were there. They went all across a shelf. I had never seen them transcribed, and he said they were great and they were helping him and so on and so forth. The tapes may still be there. Eventually, I know he wants to deposit them in his library and open them up for scholars. Exactly when he will do that, I don't know.
But I wonder how, I mean, because your book is based on your recorded recollections of these interviews that you did with Clinton. When the tapes come out, just how much your book will be like those tapes? Because you know how memory can be.
I hope it. I mean, I did it, an hour later, I'm recording it. So I think the gist of it is right, and I'm trying to be faithful. I have no agenda here. I'm trying to give you a sense of what it's like to be in the White House and the gist of what he's saying, because I thought his comments on the record were so remarkable. The tapes, the verbatim tapes in his own voice will be much, much more detailed. There were several times when I said that I wish my memory was better, because he does at times have a gift for language, where his description of the Kremlin or his description of meetings with the president of China or meetings with Newt Gingrich were pretty riveting, and I'd be laughing and everything, but I couldn't remember the whole run of the language, and I would paraphrase it. But I think the gist of it is accurate, and I'll be embarrassed for any mistakes because it's my job to create a faithful record.
Well, I've appreciated the fact that you joined us today on Radio Times. Taylor Branch, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And the book is called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. Taylor Branch, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author. In fact, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Parting the Waters. That's the third book in his trilogy of biographies on Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. That's it for today's edition, this first hour edition of Radio Times. And Taylor Branch is speaking tonight at 6:30 at the National Constitution Center. That's right across the street here on 6th Street in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Leave us an email. Find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.